Vivo qualitative data analysis software empowers researchers around the world to discover rich insights within their qualitative data. This podcast gives you unique insights into the methods, the processes, and the passions of researchers. Welcome to the Invivo podcast, Between the Data. Welcome to the Invivo podcast, Between the Data. I'm Stacey Penna, Invivo Community Director, and my guest today is Dr. Nicole Brown, a lecturer in education, the academic head of learning and teaching in the Department of Culture, Communication, and Media at the University College London Institute of Education, and she is the director of Social Research and Practice and Education Limited. And for today's podcast, we'll be focusing on Dr. Brown's work with participatory research. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Brown.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking you, what is participatory research?
So just to start off, I don't actually consider myself as a participatory researcher. So I do participatory research as part of what I do, but it's not the only thing that I'm doing. And I think that's quite important to start out with, really. So participatory research has been around for a long time, and it's actually started to develop out of the idea that a researcher shouldn't be doing research to the people. You know, you shouldn't necessarily do research for your own benefit. You should try and mitigate some of the hierarchy between, you know, the researcher and the research participant. And I think that's really the starting point where people were saying, well, actually, even though I'm the researcher, I'm not the know-it-all. Actually, the people in the community may know more about, you know, what's going on than I do. So let's do this, try to do this research together. And that's where the participatory element sort of started coming in. I think initially it was more to do with trying to reduce fears of you know, a research participant not having a voice in the research. And that's really how it started out. But actually, you know, as with all frameworks and approaches, you know, things develop, and they develop in so many different ways that I would say nowadays there isn't just one way of doing participatory research. I would say that there is so many different, there are so many different kinds and ways of how people do it. And also, obviously, there is scope regarding how much participation do you actually have in your research. So you could have, if you like, it could be on a continuum where somebody is just asking people to do particular kinds of participatory work, or it could be the people are taking over the whole idea of the research itself, and they stipulate the research question, and they create the data, or they come up with ideas as to how we can, you know, collect data together. And then takes another step further to actually say, well, you know, okay, we have, you know, come up with this research project together, and here is the data that we have collected together. Well, now it's about analysis. And obviously, again, in some cases, researchers will say, well, I'm going to, you know, sort of take more control of this, and I'm going to analyze it. Or you can say, okay, well, this is a participatory approach, so let's do the analysis together. And straight away, this brings us to some kind of, you know, potential challenges with it, because obviously somebody from the general public doesn't necessarily know the kind of theoretical framework and the philosophical underpinnings that we as researchers bring to the research. So we know about ethics. We know about, you know, the kinds of questions that you can ask in interviews. We know about, you know, trying to not ask leading questions, but somebody who's not a researcher by trade may not necessarily know that, and they may, in a way, make mistakes that as a researcher you wouldn't make. And that's obviously impacting the whole process of the data collection and ultimately analysis as well.
Great. Thank you. That's interesting. So why do you use this type of methods in your research?
So in my own research, I started out in my career. Let's start this way. In my career, I started out as a teacher. And then I became a teacher educator. And even in the classroom, when I was still a subject teacher, I always felt, obviously I was in control of the classroom and I was in control. I was the person of authority. I mean, with a bunch of 15, 16 year olds, you kind of have to be as well. So it's not that you can avoid that situation. But at the same time, even in that kind of environment, I was very consciously aware of the kind of power I had and I held over what was going on in my classroom. At the same time, even in those days, I was really interested in trying to improve my own teaching practice and trying to make my teaching better for the benefit of the students and my pupils. And that is only possible by actually working with them on it, on something. So I always, even straight when I was still a practicing teacher, I felt that I needed to somehow get to the point where they trust me enough to say, actually, this part was not very good. And that takes a lot of work. And this is where the participatory approach is really, really useful, because it basically, you know, hands back that control over the research to the people it affects. So you can say, look, actually, this is our thing together. What is the thing that we need to explore together? And by handing that control back over to the pupils, you empower them. And at the same time, they start trusting you a little bit more. So this is really why I started using a lot of the kind of the participatory approaches earlier on in my career. When I was then a teacher educator, it was a similar situation. This was a case now where I was modeling best practices. And again, I was trying to improve my own way of modeling best practices. So it was, again, working with those trainee teachers to try and help improve the classroom and the learning for all of us. Mm-hmm. In terms of my academic research nowadays, I'm actually focusing quite heavily on research with academic staff. And in a way, because I'm working with people who are researchers themselves, in a way, the participatory aspect often comes through quite naturally, because they have got that background of doing research. They know what I'm after, and they are generally interested in contributing sensibly and informatively to the agenda of the research. So that's why most of the time when I do interviews, and I do interviews as well, if you look at the transcripts of my interviews, they are not the typical kind of interview where I'd be having one question and then a long answer from another person. It tends to be a proper conversation between two people bouncing around some ideas. And I think that's really why I'm using that, simply because it's the most natural way in these situations. It's not necessarily the best way. It really depends on what it is that you're doing and who you're working with. So I know, for example, projects that have been done, especially with vulnerable people, with people with learning difficulties, where, again, the researchers were very aware that they were doing the research to the subject and they didn't like that dynamic. So they were trying to hand back that control to the people with learning difficulties. But obviously, that means that it really depends on the kind of dynamic within that group, whether they're able and willing to take that role. I mean, in their lives, in their lived experience, they're usually put into some kind of corner where they, you know, put out as if they weren't valuable members of society, as if they didn't have anything important or relevant to contribute. And now suddenly you're saying, actually, I want you to do this. This is coming with a great deal of responsibility. And some of the people will rise to the challenge, but other people will find that very, very difficult and will not like it. So it's really, like I said, it often, this kind of participatory approach often really depends on what it is that you're doing in terms of your research and what you're trying to achieve with your research. And I think where it lends itself to be introduced is tends to be the kind of research projects where you want to bring about some kind of change. I think it's more to do about try, and that's also why in some literature they are talking about participatory action research, where they're even focusing on the action element. But I think even if you don't do PAR as such, the participatory action research, I think participatory research in general is more like an activist form of research. And I think that's what it lends itself to.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So I was a sixth grade middle school teacher. And so what you're talking about with, so I changed the way I assess students to do alternative assessments with rubrics and portfolios. So sort of to bring the students into the process. So it wasn't me being subjective and assessing them. It was we would actually create the rubric together. You know, what makes a strong presentation? You know, they know, you know, and so that kind of thing. So I that's maybe why I like the participatory research, because it does lend itself to empower people that you're working with instead of you being the all knowledgeable researcher. You know, so that's great.
And the thing is, in the classroom or in the research situation, when you're working with these people, you become one of them, and you're able to kind of step away from that role of, you know, well, this is the authoritarian teacher, or this is the researcher who knows it all and we know nothing. So suddenly it's like, actually, you know what, we're all in this together, we're all learning about something together, and that's, I think that's really, really powerful.
Yeah, no, I agree. I saw a big change in the work my students did when I changed to that much stronger work. Yeah. So now just talking more about the methods around participatory research. So I thought it was interesting reading your articles and watching some of the videos that you shared with me, that you know, why do you use objects like identifying boxes, photographs, and even Legos with your research?
Yeah, well, again, to be honest, you know, I think a lot of that is natural development out of the kind of sort of research context I was working in. So, for example, the objects. Within teacher education, we do a lot of reflective practice. And there are certain models of reflection that, you know, we teach the trainee teachers to embed and basically just absorb to such a way that that becomes part of your everyday teaching experience. But to be honest, after a while, those essays and assignments just get boring to read. and the students also find them boring to write. So I was, you know, this was one of the things where I was working with my student teachers, and I said, okay, well, how can we do this differently? What can we do to make this more interesting for you as well as for me? And how can we make this more relevant? So we started playing around literally with Lego. it was initially an idea of actually sketching and drawing. And straight away, it's really interesting with the sketching and drawing. People don't like it because they think about it in an aesthetic way. So straight away, you ask somebody to draw a circle, they go, oh, this is going to be a wonky circle, this is not going to be a proper circle, this is going to be eggy or whatever. And straight away, there is a certain level of resistance to it. And that Lego takes out. So when you introduce Lego, most people remember it from their own childhood, so they're quite happy to handle it. The material itself, the plastic bricks, aren't too offensive on people's skins or anything. So again, they're happy to handle it. And when you tell them, build me a circle, everybody just goes and looks for some bricks that they can use. Nobody stops and says, actually, I can't build a round circle with square or rectangular figures. You know, nobody ever says that. It literally, everybody just has a go and starts playing with it. So I realized that I needed to find a way where we are taking the aesthetics out. And I also realized that we need to be able to use materials that people are comfortable touching. At one point, I used sandboxing as an idea. I don't know whether you've heard of that, but sandboxing is basically is a tray of sand, and then you're providing the participants, or you know, whoever you're working with little people figures and animal figures, and they can recreate scenes in that sand. So it's basically a portable sand pit, if you like. And that's quite a nice way for, especially for early years and children kind of research. But the sand for the sandboxing sand has got a particular kind of consistency that not everybody likes touching. And to be honest, some of that sand is really sticky on your hands. So even if you wash it off, it generally doesn't feel nice. And that's one of the things that I realized. So that's why I kind of stopped using the aesthetics and the material in these things. And I started using more Lego and photographs. And then I started thinking, well, actually, you know, the Lego is limited because you can't, you know, you can pretend the brick is a wall, and then you can pretend the brick is a boat, but it's still, you know, two bricks really. So I started to think about, okay, what else can we introduce that will do the same thing, but will give us a bit more flexibility around what we want to represent, what kind of experiences we would like to represent. And that's when I came up with the idea of just using objects, any kind of object. So I've done some projects where trainee teachers. I've done it with trainee researchers. I've done it with doctoral students. I've done it with trainee dancers, actually, as well, people that are going to be professional dancers. And basically, the question I ask is something like, who are you as? And then add whatever, a researcher, a dancer, whatever, and ask people to respond to that question with an object. And there are two ways that people go about that. So on the one hand, people will go around their house and just genuinely have a stroll around and see which object springs to their mind. Actually, yes, this would fit that question. And some other people are actually contemplating the question and then trying to find an object that will represent the answer that they genuinely want. So there's two kind of ways of approaching it. But in both ways, what it does is actually people are forced to think very, very deeply about their experiences, reduce all of their experiences to a real core essence of it, and then find the representation. And in the conversation I then have with them, they are able to elaborate on those compressed meanings, if you like. And that's really where the collaborative or the participatory element comes back in, because you then have this conversation where you make sense of that particular object together. And this is almost like sense making in the process of the interview, in the conversation, but also as a first layer of analysis. And that's really the exciting part. I mean, to me, this is the most interesting part. So just to give you an example, one group I had, who are you as a teacher? And one student had brought in a semi-deflated American football. And he said, you know, I see myself as a coach, as a facilitator of learning. I would like to run alongside the pitch and basically support my students in that way. And I thought that was a really powerful way of explaining it. And then I said, I totally see where you're coming from. But this ball is quite sort of semi-deflated. It's not fully inflated. And he turned around to me and said, well, actually, that's on purpose. I let out some air. So I'm like, okay, well, now you've got to explain yourself. And he said, I would like to be that coach with the fully inflated football. But unfortunately, I can't be the coach I would like to be because of external constraints, such as the national curriculum, external exams. You know, there are pressures on me as a teacher that I can't actually bypass. So therefore, I'm not the fully blown up teacher or coach I would like to be. I'm only semi-deflated. And I thought this was one of the most powerful messages that you could get across, where I'm sure in an interview, it would have been a lot flatter and not as insightful. And when you look at the photograph where this semi-deflated American football sits within all the other objects, you kind of look at the photograph and you think to yourself, actually, I genuinely understand these people. at an emotional level, not just as at a cognitive level. And I think this is, again, this element of the object work that's bringing something to the participatory research that ordinary box download interviews and surveys probably would not bring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was interesting. I like that example. Thanks for sharing that. So you sort of were talking about this, but, you know, how do you work with your participants in your study? So more maybe some of the practical things you have to do when you're working with people?
Yeah, so the first step, obviously, is trying to get through your ethics board. And that's often the most difficult thing to do, because in true sense of participatory research, you don't do one consent form. So when you do participatory research, you actually negotiate the ethics at every stage throughout the research. So it's a constant process rather than just a tick box exercise at the beginning. And therefore, trying to get that through ethics boards is sometimes a little bit difficult, because not everybody understands that this is part of how you do participatory research really well, to make sure that you're actually looking after the people at every stage. So that's kind of the first step, really. And then the next step is really to talk to people, to listen to them. I mean, I know people are saying, you know, well, they hear, but they don't listen. And I think this is really the thing, you know, it's not about hearing the people, it's really listening to what they're saying and responding to that accordingly. So I guess the one thing that is very different from this kind of research to ordinary semi-structured interviews is there is no real way of knowing what's going to happen. Sometimes the conversation trails off in ways that you haven't expected, that are leading you to areas where you just weren't prepared to go initially. But because these people are obviously in control of that research to a certain extent, you have to let that happen. So if it means that, you know, some themes come up which I haven't prepared for, well, it basically means that, okay, after that interview, I'm going to go online and try and find the relevant literature to you know, broaden my own mind, because this is what's important. And sometimes, you know, yes, of course, I've got an agenda and I would like certain questions answered. But sometimes, especially with participatory research, it may be that a different agenda happens eventually. So you have to try and negotiate those two conflicting messages. So it depends on if you're doing it as an unfunded research, you can obviously let it happen in whichever way it goes. But if your research is funded and your funder wants a specific outcome, there has to be a certain level of negotiation to make sure that, you know, you're meeting all of the objectives. So in that sense, you know, how you work with the participants is really just interacting. It's not asking them to give you their knowledge. It's asking them to be allowed to be part of their knowledge. And I think it's in that sense. I mean, I'm hoping that comes across in the research that I'm doing, but I'm hoping that I come across as somebody who's humble and just, like, you know, wants to find out. I generally am interested in the lives of these people. And I think that's really what is most important, I would say.
So with that, do you ever ask for feedback from the participants after the process to
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yes, totally, totally. The whole process is so when I have, if you like, if I've gone through the stage of data collection, I will then start looking at what themes I need to explore further. I will go back to the participants and check with them if they think that this is a true representation. So it's a case of, and I do that with transcripts as well. So if I've got a conversation transcript and I go through that and I identify a particular theme that comes up. So for example, that coach, that facilitator that I've mentioned earlier, this is something that I would then go back to the participants and I would say, well, do you think it's a fair representation to say, actually, this is something that we need to consider further. And we need to talk about what makes the facilitator, what makes a coach. And that's again, obviously, this is where they have then got the control, and they may be saying yes, but, or they may be saying no, you know, and you've got to accept that too. So I do go back at every stage. And also when I've produced some kind of outcomes, and I usually tend to produce recommendations for policies, for example, again, you know, I take those recommendations back before I share them to see whether there is anything that I have forgotten, if there's anything that I need to change that I can make better, stronger. So it's very much quite an involved process. And I guess that's one of the advantages from a participant point of view. But at the same time, it's a disadvantage because you are asking a lot of commitment from those people. Time, energy, and it's certainly easier to just say to somebody, well, let's have a 45-minute interview, than to say, okay, I want you to commit for the next 10 weeks for me to call upon you so that I can go through the things that I need to go through.
So that so how, in a typical study, how many participants do you have then? Because like you said, it's, you know.
Yes.
Also bandwidth for you. So what would be a typical size?
Yes, typically, it's, again, this is very much driven by the conversations in higher education more than anything. If you want to publish anything below 15, 20, journal articles won't touch, you know, the journals won't touch them. So it really, you have to work with, you know, probably about 20, 25 participants. I mean, in my doctoral research, I was working with academics who were diagnosed with fibromyalgia. Just very briefly, fibromyalgia is a condition which is similar to chronic fatigue syndrome, and it's got widespread pain, cognitive dysfunctions, sleep disorder, psychological disorder, so, and fatigue itself as well. So it's quite a complex condition. And for that, I recruited about 40 people. Some of them were in my pilot phase, so they were not academics, but the others were academics. And the reality of that was, because this was a longer process, and basically people had to commit to the best part of 6 months, what happened in reality was that some people were really engaged for a few weeks, then dropped off the grid for a while, and then after a while actually popped back onto the scene and said, oh, you know, I'm here again now. Now, in this particular case, it's been more complex because of the nature of fibromyalgia as a condition. I kind of expected that fluctuation to happen, because when people have flare-ups, they obviously have to cut back on the things that are not as important in their lives. And in their lives, my research wouldn't have been as important as getting to their own workplace, for example. So I was kind of prepared for that anyway. But it goes back to the thing that with participatory research, when you're asking people for a long-term commitment, you have to be prepared that it's not going to be nice and neat. It's going to be dropping in and out, floating in and out. And sometimes, to be honest, I was quite surprised where I had people dropping off the grid where I thought, okay, well, that's a shame and I've lost them. And then suddenly they do appear again. You know, it's surprising, but it's basically going back to that, because these people want to be part of the research. They want to have their stories heard. They want their voices to be heard. And I think this is the power of the participatory research. It's not necessarily onerous for those people. Within the grand scheme of things, obviously, everyday management of symptoms and that, yes. But actually, you know, for them, this is their way of giving back to the community, of raising awareness for the condition, of making sure people understand that this is not just something that's in your mind. This is an actual disease and an actual illness. So you've got things here that, you know, with an individual interview of 45 or 60 minutes, I probably wouldn't have been able to capture in that same way.
Great. Thank you. We'll take a quick break from the podcast to share that you can learn more about Dr. Nicole Brown's work with participatory research by visiting her website at www.nicole-brown.co.uk. And to enhance your learning, collaboration, teaching, and research, visit Dr. Brown's Moodle space called Social Research and Practice and Education at moodle.nicole-brown.co.uk. So could you explain how you your process with interpreting the objects that you ask people to work with?
Yes, so this is an interesting one, because analysis, obviously, in ordinary circumstances, analysis is seen as we're reading a transcript, we're putting it into NVivo, recoded. And then, and if you read research articles, it will say, and then the themes emerged, and these themes emerged. And I really have a problem with that, because as good as NVivo is, when I put something in it, the codes don't just pop up. I have to create them. I have to make them. And that's where, you know, the research literature often is a little bit misleading, because it suggests that, you know, it somehow happens naturally. And what's interesting, when you use objects, the process is exactly the same. You're looking at the object, you're looking at what you see, whether this is a text, as in a written transcript, or a photograph of somebody hunched over a desk, it doesn't really matter. You look at what you see and you interpret. And I think that the difficulty is that because we don't do that often enough in formal settings, people think that they can't do or shouldn't do a visual analysis because they haven't been trained in the arts. But if we're honest about it, how many of us had formal training of interpreting text? We would have had formal training of how to use a software, for example, NVivo, as to, you know, here are the functionalities, this is what you can do. But nobody, or hardly any training, is available that says, okay, when the research participant says this, this is really what this means. You know, this is something that we just assume we know how to do. And we probably do, because that's what we do when we read the newspaper, when we, you know, in everyday life, any kind of social media postings, we interpret automatically. But this jump between working with text and working with objects or visual representations of something, people are very, very reticent to make, because they think that there is a different set of skills or requirements needed. And my argument always is, actually, there is not. I mean, you know, and then people say to you, well, but this person hunched over the photograph of the person hunched over the desk, that could mean that this person is just tired, having a sleep, or it could mean the person is depressed and is having a cry. How do you know which one is true? Well, the same argument could be made about the text. How do you know that your interpretation is true and correct? You don't, unless you go back and ask the participants. So the only difference for me between working on textual interpretations and object interpretations is how much do you go back to ask what they meant by it. Now, I can interpret an object or you know, a photograph on its own. And I do that. I do look at the object, at the artifact on their own. But then I do go back to have a conversation with the participants about them. And I ask them, what did you mean by this? And that gives me then a second layer, because it gives me my original interpretation and their interpretation. And that allows me to come up with a third level of interpretation. So actually, the interpretation becomes more... how should I say, richer. It becomes richer than just doing, you know, that first level of textual analysis. Now, in good participatory research, the researcher would go back to the participants asking them about the codes. Mm-hmm. So this is one element of participatory research. But again, you know, like I said at the beginning, it depends on how much you want the participants to be involved in that process. If you want to have really high levels of participation, then this would be the point where you go back and you ask them, actually, this is the sense I have made of this. What sense do you make of this? But most often, that's the part where participatory research somehow becomes no longer participatory because the researcher takes control of that stage. With the objects, I would suggest you're probably more likely to be forced to go back because you know that there are so many opportunities for this glass of water to mean whatever it means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have the participants send you the picture or the object, whatever they're mm-hmm. doing, and then you first interpret it yourself, and then you go and ask them.
Yes.
And do you ask them if your interpretation's correct, or you just have them explain what they're seeing?
Yes, both. So initially, how I do the process tends to be: I look at the object, I see what I see, I interpret what I see, I make a note of what I see, I also make a note of how I react to this, which is a really interesting one because sometimes you see things that make you cringe or that make you upset. And it's quite important to kind of notice that because that information is particularly useful when it comes to trying to disseminate findings later on. Because if it has had such a powerful effect on you, you know that you can make use of that effect and recreate that effect in some way for the dissemination stage as well. So that's one of the things that I do. I make a note of the object, what I see and how I interpret it, but also how I react to it. And then I ask the participants, okay, you sent me a photograph of a glass of water. What did you mean by that? And then they will explain what they meant by this. And then I will say, well, this is interesting because this is what I saw and this is how I interpreted it. And then we will be talking about this with, some participants will say, oh, that's interesting. Yes, you're right. This could also be the case because, and then you're talking about that. Mm-hmm. Some other participants may say, oh, no, that's definitely wrong. And that's fine, you know. But it's a case of this is where, you know, your initial thoughts and your initial reactions are quite important. And I think this is about me probably being quite aligned with what's embodied inquiry, that I'm very much listening to my gut feeling, as to this is what's interesting here, and that's the path that I'm pursuing.
And is it typically you're interviewing the person with the object, or is it could it be through email or a combination of things?
It's a combination of things. Most often it happens to be that I get sent a photograph, and I always, if I ask people to send photographs, I always ask them to write down what I can see on the photograph, because sometimes lighting is bad or sometimes the photograph is slightly blurry. So, you know, I may not be able to see that this is a pencil, you know, so it's good to know, okay, what you see here is a pencil. Well, that's good to know. I don't need to know what you mean by the pencil, but I need to know that this is a pencil in the first place. So that's quite a useful kind of starting point for me. And then I see, okay, well, I got this, you know, this was the question, this is the answer. And I try to make sense of that. And then it depends, again, this is about listening to what the research participants want. Some of them would have 10 emails rather than having a 10-minute conversation. Other people are like, no, actually, I prefer having 10 conversations rather than sending one email. So it really goes back to that, which is the problem with the ethics process, because you're negotiating at every stage what you do and how you do it together. And for some people, it's a very individualized process and a very personalized process. But therefore, you know, my data sets look rather messy. And, you know, I know that there is this thought that, you know, data sets need to be uniform for them to mean something. To be honest, I hardly ever have any uniformity in my data set simply because I may have, you know, these 5 pictures with a conversation from this one person. On this one, I may have, you know, 2 pictures with three conversations with this person. Then I may have one picture with 10 emails attached to them. So it's very, very individual and personal. Hmm. At the end of the day, for me, the important thing is that I'm just wanting to find out what they experience and what they feel and what they think. And whichever way is best for them to communicate that, that works for me.
Mm-hmm. So that gets into my next question on, well, how do you manage and analyze all that data? Because you just described a lot of forms of data.
Yes, I know. It is rather messy. I mean, like, I've got two forms of analysis that I tend to do. I use a traditional form where I put the conversations into InVivo. I also put the photographs into InVivo, and I analyze and code according to the traditional kind of setup. But then there is the second part of me where I'm making sense of the data in a way that's more drawing on the arts-based research. So I will be the one that, you know, reads something in 10 transcripts and thinks, okay, they are telling me, for example, if I go back to the research that I did with the academics on fibromyalgia, one of the questions that I was exploring for myself was what is academic identity? And when you read through all of the data that I had, the transcripts, the photographs, soundtrack, actually I was sent some soundtrack as well. So once you had all of those things together, I was thinking to myself, okay, well, what does all of this tell me in terms of what academic identity looks like? And quite naturally, I grabbed some books, a laptop, some pens, marker, a highlighter, a staff badge, and a lab coat. And I put it out in my own house as an installation, and I took a photograph of it. And I felt this is what they're telling me that academic identity looks like if I'm trying to recreate that as an installation. So once I had that photograph, I took it back to the participants and I said, oh, do you think that this is what academic identity looks like? And quite collectively, they all said yes, but your image is missing something and it's missing the white male. And that was interesting because they were all talking about this, but obviously I didn't have this image that, you know, that I thought that they wanted me to represent, which was an elderly person with white hair, white man. And I obviously didn't have such a person to my, you know, in my vicinity or proximity. So I basically just took the photograph without the actual person in it. And they were like, yes, this is a very good representation, apart from the man that's missing. But this is the kind of way that's trying to make sense of the data at an almost intuitive level. So yes, it was, and that actually helps me understand the data better as well, because the fact that they found the white male so important was something that I probably hadn't realized how important it was until we had that conversation about it. So that then helps you go back to the coding and say, actually, I need to look for these elements because this is what's important here. So the two forms of analysis go together, but at the same time, the art-based approach is probably not as easily disseminated, especially in academic journals, whereas the traditional form with coding and themes, that is what seems to be the currency within academia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, but the arts-based analysis helped you find some, like, sort of a gap, right, with the coding. So then you could go back and do that coding. So that's interesting. So going into more your results, so how does the participatory research that you do sort of enhance your findings? I mean, one, you just sort of gave that example partly, but is there anything else that you can think of?
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is that it's a very personal experience and very deep level interpretation of individual experiences. And you are then able, because I'm then using those objects for dissemination as well, it helps people that are looking at the data to connect with that at an emotional level. So, for example, the semi-deflated football, if I'm putting that there now, because I've explained to you the kind of story behind it, you will look at it and you will see the power of that football. And if I put then next to it a text where this whole episode is described, it just doesn't connect in that same way. And I think this is really where the participatory element, especially with the object work, is really important, that you're able to tap into what's essential, what's the core of this, what is at the crux of your experience. And I think that's what may not be coming through as easily in interview situations where there is this distance between the researcher and the subject.
Great, thank you. And then because the participatory research part of it is trying to make a change, you know, because you're with what's happening, can you give any examples where that has happened? Or
yes, absolutely. So for example, from the research with fibromyalgia, I started from that. These people were talking to me about being invisibly ill, and that not being recognized in academia that they are actually ill. And they were also talking to me about concerns around that, the fact that they can't actually disclose their conditions. So in the research with the academics with fibromyalgia, one of the things that came out of that was that they were worried that they couldn't really disclose their condition because of the stigma that's involved around the condition itself. And they also talked about being invisibly ill and that being problematic, because obviously it meant that, you know, they wouldn't be as productive as somebody who doesn't have a condition. But because you can't see it, it's like, well, actually, are they really ill at all in the first place? So there's a whole host around that. And the fact that I was able to, you know, use those experiences to basically improve my own understanding of what's actually going on there, I was able to identify that what really was going on was that they were constantly comparing themselves against people who are able and able-bodied. And that led to a conference. So I thought, well, actually, you know what, this is an interesting topic. You know, and what happened was around the same time, there was a book launch in America of the book called Academic Ableism. And unfortunately, you weren't able to be part of that book launch unless you were on the campus. Because I emailed the people, I said, oh, can I have access to the live stream? And they're like, oh, no, we don't do that. So I said, oh, well, can I have access to the materials then? Oh, no, we don't do that. Well, can you give me access to the recordings then? Oh, no, we don't do that. So I felt, well, hang on a minute. On the one hand, I've got people here that talk to me about having to be able-bodied at all times. On the other hand, I've got an event about academic ableism that's completely inaccessible to anyone who's not able to get to the place. Well, why don't I try to do something with that? So from that, I then developed a conference which was called Ableism in Academia in 2018. It was held in March in London. And from that, I made that conference totally accessible. So we had live stream, live interpreters. It had everything. It had gluten-free food, diabetic food. It was literally, we had different tables and chairs and all sorts of, you know, like cushions and blankets and socks and eye patches, literally everything. I even had a bowl of water ready in case somebody turns up with a guide dog. That's how minute the detailed planning was. It was really, really detailed. And what we did was we had this conversation about, you know, with people talking from their experiences, not just with fibromyalgia, but a load of different kinds of conditions around, you know, ableism and saying things like hidden disabilities or hidden invisible illnesses. So we have people talking, for example, about depression, anxiety, autism. We have people talking about color blindness, which, you know, people don't realize that this is a big thing. But if you're a statistician and you need to read graphs, it is a massive thing, right? So you've got all these different kinds of experiences, and people were literally just sharing them. And in the afternoon, we then had a workshop on, okay, well, these were our experiences. What can the universities do to make this better? From that, I've been able to develop two edited books, which are coming out in October and then in March. I have, within one of them, there is a whole sort of section on guidelines for how universities can be made more accessible. In the other edited books, there are strategies within each chapter of how people can become more accessible and teach in more accessible ways for a whole host of different conditions and illnesses. And all of that was only possible because, first of all, the fibromyalgia participants were talking to me about their experiences. But then the conference was laid out as a participatory action research project. And to be honest, publishing on that is really, really hard. We've got one article that we're really struggling to get into an academic journal because they are saying, oh, but this is not a traditional way of publishing. This was not a traditional way of doing research. And I'm like, no, it wasn't. But that doesn't make it any worse or less valuable. Actually, this is exactly what it should be because it's come out of the activism of some 100 people, you know?
Yeah. No, that's great. That's really exciting. So, but you did were able to do the books though. So that was okay to get the edited books.
Yes. The edited books, articles. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the edited books, that's quite different because you can obviously, with the publishing companies, you can kind of explain that a lot better. And you can kind of explain to why people will want to see that. But with the journals, it's different because that process is a peer-reviewed process. Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, despite the fact that you're trying to say, well, this is important, people need to read about this, you know, the peer reviewers don't necessarily see the activism that goes on behind there.
Yeah.
So trying to get that published, to be honest, has been is really, really hard.
So if somebody was trying to you do participatory research and maybe hasn't done a lot of it, what are some of the benefits and challenges around the method?
So I think some of them I've kind of mentioned already. Like, I think, you know, one of them is that people don't necessarily, you know, like understand it, as in the people that you're working with, they will understand it. But the people that you have to explain it to, for example, journals, sometimes don't understand what you do and why you do that. Ethics boards don't necessarily understand that. So there's a lot of negotiation that goes on there, which is sometimes, you know, sort of difficult and makes for hard work. The other thing is, in terms of the participants themselves, again, I think I've mentioned some of this, is that the commitment that you're asking for is an important factor. At the same time, you almost have to kind of think about training some of the participants to be researchers. And that's requiring extra kind of support and stages of developing that. Mm-hmm. Now, in my research, because I was working with academics, that, or I am most of the time, that's not an important factor. But if you are using people from the general public, then this is something that's really important, where you have to train them to a certain extent to be able to do the participatory element of the work. So I guess that those are kind of some of the considerations that you have to put in. I mean, you know, I know I do talk about challenges myself and obstacles that you overcome, but at the end of the day, I wouldn't be doing it if I weren't able to see how much actually this brings. And it brings so much to the research experience, and it helps so much in kind of disseminating experiences and raising awareness and changing attitudes that it's definitely worth doing it. You know, even despite all of the hassle that you get, actually, it's definitely worth doing it.
Yeah. Great, thank you. And how about any gaps in the literature that you find?
Well, to be honest, there was one gap, but that's being filled now. So there is a whole journal now that is dealing with participatory research, and I think that's really important, because you know there are so many journals out there that are dealing with different aspects of things, but a whole journal just dedicated to participatory research, that's really exciting. That's an exciting idea. Because it allows for that kind of conversation about, okay, what is the scope? Where is the continuum? What is participatory approach, and what is not? And is, you know, is this a valid approach or not? And I think this is the part where the actual conversations can happen. So in a way, this was the thing that was missing. And somebody has started taking that on as a project, and there is now a journal that's called Journal for Participatory Research Methodology, and I think that's the one thing that was missing. Obviously, there are then little things that are missing where, you know, people can contribute some really substantial pieces of work. But, you know, sort of trying to scope out the philosophy and the practices and the overarching framework, I think that's what was really needed.
So I like to ask at the end, what's one piece of advice you would give somebody who's working with participatory research?
Enjoy. Enjoy. To me, that's you see, I know... You know, sometimes when we read research articles, the research that's presented is all smooth and perfect, and there are no hiccups, and everything was pretty, and it's not like that. Definitely not. It's messy. It's frustrating. It's upsetting. It's everything. But it's a real emotional roller coaster. But when you look back on it and you look as to what you have achieved as with the research and the impact it's had on the individual participants and on, you know, some kind of society as a whole, it's just beautiful. And that's why I'm saying, you know, even if it's frustrating, you know, to actually just say to yourself, well, you're doing this for a reason and you're doing this for the greater good. And I think this is really what it has to be done for. So, yeah, just go with the flow and enjoy.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us for this podcast, Between the Data. I'm sure our listeners have found this very helpful to learn more about participatory research. So thank you, Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much. And it was good talking to you.
Thank you for joining us for Between the Data. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more about In Vivo podcasts and community events, please visit go.invivobyqsr.com/community or email me, Stacy Penna, at s.penna, P-E-N-N-A, @qsrinternational.com.